This is the podcast that we ask our guests from in front and behind the camera, how did they get their foot in the door? What was the key to unlocking their success? What's their story?
From the Bronx to kindergarten teacher and now Hollywood. Our guest today directed Will Smith to his Oscar win in The Brilliant King Richard. Now he's taking on the legacy of Bob Marley. We chat about being driven to follow your dreams and against all odds, believe in yourself. And do the thing you love because you love it and not for the money. Case in point, after four films and three TV series, he's only just paid off his student loan. Our guest today is director Ronaldo Marcus Green.
To ask, if I may, and my podcast is about how people started their career as well, so I'd love to, you know, this is amazing you're doing this film, and I was a massive fan of King Richard as well, but I'd love to know, like, how this career began, how you started this journey, because I've heard that you almost became a baseball player, is that correct?
Well, I think my recollection of my skills are probably higher than they were. But yeah, I think in college there was a moment where maybe I had a chance, and I had two major league tryouts for my favorite team, actually, the New York Mets, and I didn't make it. And so I just had to get a job like everybody else. And so I think my first career, I was an elementary school teacher. I taught kindergarten through fifth grade for 2 years in New Jersey. And, at the time I had a girlfriend, and her father was working in Wall Street. And we were getting pretty serious and gave me an opportunity to kind of switch careers and move into that space. So I ended up working for AIG, insurance company. That relationship ended, but we remained friends. But I ended up on Wall Street in working in diversity and talent acquisition for a big company. But of course, the 2008 crisis hit, and what do? They cut the diversity part, as if we were the ones that brought down the entire global economy. But I remember I was given like 30 days informal notice, which was unheard of at the time, actually. Usually you get your pink slip and you're out on Friday, you know, with maybe a severance or maybe not. And that in that 30 days, I asked everybody that I'd met in the 5 years that I was working there to, you know, can I get a job? And I wound up in product development. And I just thought, great, I have a job. I felt some security, but I wasn't doing... I kind of wound up in a place that I didn't... I was a little lost, you know? Now I'm 24, 25 years old at this time and thinking, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing with my life? I somehow wound up in this space, and I have an older brother that's a filmmaker. And so I saw him go to NYU, and he's now traveling the world on his art. I thought... It's really cool what he's doing. And so I thought, you know, let me apply to film school and just see. Maybe we can become the Green Brothers. My brother would direct and I would produce. Mm-hmm. And there we go. And so I applied to NYU, Tisch Graduate Film School, and I got in. So my focus was to produce films. And at that point, but it's a writing directing program. So you can produce. Mm-hmm. And I was producing for several of my classmates. But make a long story short, I also started to write and direct. And those short films started to have some success. Mm. And I started to question, wait, maybe I am a director, you know. And that's exactly what happened. I started to do it and started to have some success. And I guess with that success, other people started saying, you know, Ray, you are a director. You should really try to pursue this, like, in a real way. So, yeah, I remember... telling my brother, I think I'm going to stop producing for a little bit and try this other thing. And speaking of that, one of those short films was called Stone Cars. And that was one of the films that Ziggy Marley had seen. And it was one of the first things he referenced when I got this film. So it was interesting that my film school short was the thing that essentially got me the Bob Marley job. Mm. Not King Richard Oscar. It was that one. It was like, oh, wait, the 14-minute short film that I shot in South Africa because it was real. I shot it with no lights, no money, a skeleton crew. I think the whole short, maybe even the travel to South Africa, was less than $5,000. We all lived in one house, slept on floors, but there was something so pure about that filmmaking process. And I wanted to, I think Zigu, when he saw that, I think he felt that. He felt the emotion of the short films and said, that's what I want in this film about my father. And so I knew we were aligned on doing something quite special, something different, something, you know, that wasn't your traditional musical biopic. So yeah, that was kind of my journey into film. Obviously, you know, I made my first feature, Monsters of Men, 2017, premiered 2018 at Sundance. And from there, you know, it's been kind of nonstop. Made a couple films, I think four feature films now, three television series, and yeah, no intention to stop anytime
soon.
You're doing
all right, man. You're doing pretty well.
Thank you.
To go from, you know, as you say, a low-budget short film, and now here you are promoting this movie, and you know, done a movie about Bob Marley. Does that sink in? Is that kind of crazy? I mean, from my point of view, sitting here, I'm going, fair play. Like, yeah. Do you ever sit back and think, wow, yeah, like, amazing to have had these opportunities? And
I mean, for sure, it's incredible to even think that I get to do this for a living, you know. This is the closest thing to playing baseball. I get to, you know, my teammates are my crew members. You know, I feel like every film is an opportunity to win a championship, whatever that is, or a World Series. So it just feels like I'm an athlete, and I get to prepare like that. I get to go to, you know, and when you love sports, you just play. There's no, you know, I was the kid that you had to, like, you know, the lights would shut off at the baseball field, and I'm still playing. You know, I was just that kid, which is why I think I stay on the field so much. I don't like the feeling of too much quiet. I like to stay busy. I stay active. And some of my favorite filmmakers are the guys that are continually making films. Ridley Scott, Spike Lee, Scorsese. And, you know, they're making a film a year, you know, and it's about practice. And there's so many of the films that you don't know that they made, but we remember the great ones. And so it's just, they just never got off the field. And I just feel that same kind of energy for myself. Is I just want to keep playing. I don't know when the bottom's ever going to drop out. And I just, maybe it's imposter syndrome or whatever it is. But we certainly, you know, I love what I do. I'm very passionate about it. Very passionate about this film. But if I'm on this, like, and this is how I am with my crew members and my cast members. You have me forever. This is not now. And a lot of my crew members get married or they fall in love. Like, that's the type of energy that I try to bring to my sets, is that they should be best friends when they leave this process. You know, this film lives forever. This is not just now. This is not timely. This is timeless. That's at least the goal. And it's not just in the film itself, but it's in the filmmaking process. You have to, you know, you immediately become roommates with people, you know, that you've just met. Like, hey, by the way, we're going to live together, you know, forever. And, you know, not everybody's going to be best friends, but, you know, you certainly try to provide an environment of love and a caring space for people to do their best work. And I think so far, whether it was John David Washington in my first film or Kelvin Harrison Jr. or Anthony Ramos, you know, Will Smith, like, I've had these collaborative partnerships, and now Kingsley and Lashana, hopefully they'll be best friends forever, make five more movies together. I'm really excited about what we've created here with Bob Marley, One Love.
You just described that as what I love. It's part of being part of a family on set, and that kind of, just that camaraderie, and you're all kind of you're going for the same goal, aren't you? You're all working hard to try and create something beautiful. And with this film, I mean, you really have, like, it must be after, you know, how long did it take to shoot? Because, like, obviously the period of shooting it, and then you've got to do the edit. When you get to the end of it, are you sick of watching it a million times over, or are you still buzzing from the fact that you got to create this?
You know, I think that it's what's great about the filmmaking process, especially on a film of this size. You know, there's so many different, you know, the writing process was myself and a writer in a room for a year. You know, or he would write, send it to me. I'd write, send it to him. So you're alone, you know. So that's quiet and lonely and hard and Not fun. It's fun when you do something right, but it's a lot of not fun.
Is that process when you're doing that, is that solely what you're doing? Are you completely focused on writing that one thing and then that's that year? Or do you kind of, is it one project at a time? Because you do feel like you're constantly working. You've got like...
Yeah, I think this, I was lucky because Zach is a true writer. That's what he does. He's not a writer director. And so I knew I had someone that could focus 100% of the time on the script. And for me, I'm a writer director. So I feel like, unless I'm writing something specifically for myself, from scratch, it's a bit different. And so, yeah, I could let him run with a lot of this stuff and then come back to me and we can pass it off in a different way. So I could focus on a few other things at that time. And so, that's when you're doing a kind of collaboration in that way. Mm. And I needed that for this film. I knew that he was going to dive deep into the research and be able to kind of crack something structurally that's his strength. And so I knew that we had that ability together. And then, the filming process is massive. I mean, you've got all your department heads, you've got so many, departments in this. There was a lot of visual effects. So 250 people on set any given day, which is a lot, for 4 or 5 month stretch. Mm. So it's a lot of people, a lot of questions, of course, but that's what the job is, right? And then in the edit, it's myself and an editor in a room, trapped again.
It's kind of like this, isn't it? Like, really, really.
It's emotional. You're like, you go from all of that. But I love the edit process because, first of all, I love my editor, Pamela Martin, who's incredible. She cut King Richard for me, but Little Miss Sunshine, The Fighter. We also brought on an editor, Nick Huey, so shout out to Nick. But yeah, just that process of sitting in the room with Pam for 10 weeks, 12 weeks, and looking at the film fresh, mm-hmm. as if nothing we did before mattered, because it's only what you capture. Yeah. It's only what you capture. It's not what you think you capture. And Pam's very quick to remind me of, no, this is what you have. Not this is what you think you have. And that process is really interesting because you go back into the writing process again. Mm-hmm. And I love the editing process because it's quiet and you can really be objective about those pieces. Okay, well, now it's a fresh canvas again. Mm-hmm. We can do whatever we want. And I think you just have to go into it as a brand new day every single day. You can't remember the pain of getting the scene. You can't remember the joy of getting a scene. None of that matters in the grand scheme of actually editing the film. You have to forget it all. You have to forget whether it was hard to make or you hated that day or whatever it was. You just have to have short-term memory because the footage is telling you what the movie's going to be. But I think, it's all the prep work that goes in. It's all the long hours with Robert Elswit and location scouting and spending... All of that prep work is what pays dividends in the edit. Mm. It's kind of like a marathon runner. I guess if you made it to the 26th mile or whatever it is, it wasn't an accident. It was all the time that you had put in before. And so there's a reward, certainly, in that process, even in your shortcomings. I mean, all you're constantly doing is looking at all your failures. did I fail... it's a series of failures, but you're just like, wait, okay, we still passed, we still did enough to get to this point. And so it's quite an emotional process for sure. You try to remove all of that from it, but and just try to be objective. What would my mom want to see when she goes to the theater? And I have to think about that when I go into the film. It's not about me anymore. It's about the audience. What do they want to see? And hopefully we've done enough to capture that by the time we get into the edit.
Mm. I have to say, the screening I went to last night, the audience were loving it. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah, obviously done something good. Right.
Did they laugh when the Gandolfini scene happened and they were like, what did you say?
No, there was loads of, and I didn't expect that from the film as well, that it would be funny. There's a couple of really nice, funny moments in there. Which I think is just such a, no matter what the film is, even if it's a dark film, if it's, whatever it's about, it's always great to get that little bit of humour in there. There was definitely more than a few laughs in there
for sure.
Good. In terms of, you're doing so well, obviously, with this movie, and for young directors, writers, people coming into the industry, would you dare to give advice to someone kind of, maybe they wanted to be a baseball player, but then they started to think about going into the industry? What would you say to them?
Yeah, just say, look, you should love it. You know, whether I worked at Starbucks or Chuck E. Cheese, whatever my jobs were, I took it 100%. I wanted to be the best at being dancing as the rat. I definitely wanted to do that. And I don't know why. It's just who I am. If I'm going to do it, whether I'm a cook or delivering pizza, I want to do it to the best of my ability. So if acting or filmmaking is what you want to do, you should try to be the best at it. You know, try to give it 110%. Treat it like a full-time job. But I think, you know, the short-term reward thing is tough. So if you're after that, maybe this isn't the industry. You know, you might get lucky, but, you know, this is not the industry to try to get lucky. You should do it because you're passionate about it and this is what you love. But I think passion can be in any field, whether you're a second AC or second assistant editor, or the lead actor, number one on the call sheet. You know, you should just 110%. So once I decided that filmmaking was going to be, this is my life. My family travels with me. You know, this was the commitment that we were making even as a family. And look, if I ever got to the point in my career where this didn't make me happy anymore, I would leave it. I'm not the kind of person to stay in it. If I don't feel fulfilled. Yeah, that doesn't mean that there aren't hard days or it's not tough, but I just love it. You know, that's part of the grind. Part of the grind is just loving what you do. And when you have that passion, I think it can lead you to a lot of different ways. So yeah, I wouldn't get into it for short-term gains. I don't think that's what I'm after, for sure not. You know, this is a journey for sure, and trying to enjoy the process of it. And yeah, there's a lot of failure. There's a lot of rejection. I mean, everyone told me no in film school. Don't do it. Don't make that. Don't go to South Africa to make stone cars. Well, why not? Well, you're not South African. Yeah, but I feel compelled to make it. So you have to be your own voice. Something has to lead you to continue to say, well, something is telling me, keep going, keep doing this. And listen to yourself. Don't listen to everybody else. And it's hard, right? There's social media. There's so much. Yeah. There's so much noise, and it's hard to like look in the mirror and just ask yourself, why am I doing this? And I try to check in with myself a lot. Why am I doing this? Why am I making Batmore? Why me? And just constantly ask yourself. And if you are able to give yourself that answer, then I think you're in the right place. But if you're constantly second guessing what you're doing, or why you're doing it, or it's a vanity thing, it's hard to sustain. I think people can read that too. They read it in the work, or it feels superficial, it feels false. So I think if you stay true to those things, then yeah, go for it. It's an expensive endeavor for sure, whether it's an emotional one or a financial one. You know, you're not going to get rich quick. It's just not that. It's not that thing. I mean, I was telling my publicist, Bebe Lerner, that, you know, I just paid off my student loan like a year ago. This is after four movies. So it's a grind. I'm not in it for that. I'm in it for, you know, so that my kids can know who Bob Marley is. And yeah, one day I'd like to buy a house. That'd be nice. But, you know, we'll get it in due time when the time is right.
Thanks, man, for your honesty, because I feel like that's, like, so many people kind of presume it's all these are like just money and all these things, but the fact you've done so many amazing projects and you can be honest and say that, I mean, fair play, man. Yeah, that's mad. That blows my mind, to be honest.
Well, maybe in the UK it's a little different, right? Because you guys don't have the loans that we have in the schools in the US.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, again, what are you after? What is it for? You know, if you love what you do, if you just want to be a great actor, then it's also like what level. I think the industry tells you where you're at. I don't know. I'm doing the best work that I can, but you know, I know where I want to go. If I say, okay, I want to have a career like Spike Lee, or I want to have a career like Scorsese, then it's not up to me. It's up to me to do the work, but it's not up to me to tell me I'm at that level. You know, the industry is always going to remind you, oh, you're still down here, kid, or whatever, you know. So I don't know. I'm just going to continue to try to level up. But yeah, it's all about continuing the process and trying to enjoy some of it as you're doing.
Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/lifeandfilm, where you'll get episodes early and uncut, amongst other treats. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a positive rating. Add us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, at Life in Film Pod, and find our video episodes on YouTube by searching Elliot James Langridge, Life in Film. Essentially, please like and subscribe everything. It makes a huge difference. Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you work in the film industry? Are you freelance? Or perhaps you have a 9-to-5? No matter what you do, mental health affects us all. I struggled early on in my career with the uncertainty of if and when I would ever work again, struggling to pay my bills, or simply with anxiety. Don't know about you, but being an actor, it's very important for me to maintain structure in the down times. And I found not only exercise, but talking to someone, for me, was a game changer. And so Life in Film has partnered with BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet, or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm.
And back to the show.
Bob, they try to kill you and your wife. And now you're choosing to return to Jamaica to play a peace concert? Don't you fear for your life?
So we gonna walk. Through the roads of creation.
My life is not important to me.
Are you satisfied?
My life is for people.
With the life you're living.
Do you really think this world will make it?
Yes. Yeah. There's no other way.
That's the source of your strength.
We know where we're from. When the man Babylon. We're going to our fatherland. We know where we're going. We know where.
One love, one heart, one destiny.
Really enjoyed the movie, and I had no sort of... I know the music of Bob Marley, obviously, but this was a real education. I really learned a lot about his story and his journey. How did this... Obviously, you're credited as a writer and obviously the director. How did this project come about for you?
Yeah, I was editing King Richard at the time, and I got the script in my inbox, and I said, a film about Bob Marley. I had to think, it hadn't been done. And I just thought, is this real? You know, even before I wanted to read the script, I thought I should just check to see if this is real, and do they have the rights to the music? And so did some recon and heard that they had the music rights and thought, okay, if they have the music, well, maybe that's a pretty great starting point. And then I remember having a call with the producers, which was Ziggy Marley and Bob Tidal at the time. And yeah, so I said, okay, Ziggy Marley's on this call. This must be real. So the family was involved, and I thought that was super important for me. So they had the music, I had Ziggy, and said, okay, well, if I can bring on a writer and kind of, you know, shape this thing, then just maybe we might be able to make a film. And that's when the process really started for me at that point. Then obviously it took some time for the deals and
time,
all that other stuff to work out. And then I remember approaching Zach Balin, who wrote King Richard, and we had such a great collaboration on that project. And I think what he did so well on that script was choose the timeline in which we chose to focus on the Williams family. And so I thought, okay, he can really help me with this structure and really crack that portion of the story, which is so important about Bob's life. And that's when we went on that journey. It's probably a year to get the script in shape and put those things together, and then obviously start the casting process. And that took about a year, if not longer.
I mean, that must have been pretty daunting as well. Now you've got to find Bob Marley. How did you find your Bob Marley? Was there a huge audition process, or what was the? How did you go about it?
Yes. So yeah, it was a huge. Yeah, I think everyone was submitting tapes from all over the world and for months and months. And quite frankly, it was just obviously it's really hard. You're looking for Bob and everything. You know, even really good actors, which is just off the mark, you know, whether it was their look, which completely took them out. So it's just you're looking for a needle in the haystack, and it was just one of those things. And but I think my failsafe was like, okay, I'm either going to find Bob or I'm not. I can't make the movie without finding Bob. And, you know, there's rights issues on these things, and if you go into another year, there's a whole situation. Mm. So I think we were coming to the end of, is this even going to be possible? No one's close. I don't have anybody that I feel confident enough to go into this picture with.
No audition, and I saw Kingsley, who plays my father. He was the one who kept my attention. Kingsley do a great job in an artful way, not trying to mimic my father.
And then Kingsley's tape appeared. And I didn't really know Kingsley. I guess I had seen him and didn't realize that it was him. But when I saw his tape, obviously, he just jumped off the screen. He was magnetic. He was he was charismatic. His presence alone was very interesting. He's striking. He just has this thing. And there was something interesting, you know, where he put the camera was really interesting. He wasn't, you know, there wasn't two different shots and close-ups. It wasn't a mimic of an interview online, which many of the tapes were. Yeah. It was a real interpretation of Bob. And I thought the patois was quite strong. I didn't understand what he was saying, which was great. You know, actually, a lot of them were kind of in the cool runnings. You know, yeah, man. So yeah. It was almost too clear. And so I think what was great about his tape was somewhere in between. Mm. And so he had me leaning in, for sure. And then I remember calling, talking to Ziggy, talking to the producers after, just about, I think we found something here. And I think they all saw what I saw. I think the studio saw what I saw. And at that point, it was, okay, I have to imagine him with dreads. I have to imagine him with some mild prosthetics. What is that? And how tall is he? It's, you know, all the questions that come into it. But, you know, the least of it was the music and the dancing part. I needed a good actor, and I knew I had found someone that could potentially do it, and that's where the real process began transforming into Bob.
Mm. Well, the actor that plays in Kingsley, I know him from like British film, TV, and so like when I saw the trailer the first time, I was like, who is that guy?
Yeah.
And I was like, it looks familiar. And I was like, wow, because it really is a transformation, and it must be hard when you're playing a character like that to not do the stereotypical kind of, and as you say with the tapes, people were doing a little bit of a kind of stereotypical accent maybe. And that was one of the things that struck me about the film, watching it, that the accents, I was finding it hard to understand them, but it made it feel really real. I was like, what are they saying? And then like, people were laughing in the audience. I was like, I didn't hear what he said kind of thing. And the performance is just so, I mean, that's nerve-wracking for an actor.
Oh, can only imagine. Wait,
yeah, I mean, when you were on set, obviously you do a great tape and everything else, but it must feel like there's a lot of pressure when you're doing a film about someone who's so loved, so iconic. Was there the first day jitters when you were on set and you're thinking, right, okay, here's Bob Marley in front of me, and did it feel like a big moment to be like, is this going to work, sort of thing?
Yeah, I think we're still in that. I don't know, it's tough to relax. You know, it's Bob. Yeah. So I think the level of pressure that we put on ourselves is pretty high, and I think that was every department. I think because of Bob, everybody that came to this film had this idea of protecting him and protecting his legacy and not wanting to mess it up, but we're coming as fans, and so it's, you know, there was a lot of love from every department poured into this, and But yeah, you could feel that pressure for sure. It was certainly high tension in sort of a sports way. You know, it's like a playoff game, or I don't know how to describe it. That sort of, yeah, the feeling that you're in this really intense match because it's high level, and you know one slip or one thing, one false note, and it kind of blows the film up. And that whether you're doing a big concert scene or you're just writing on a pad, you know, it's all taken that seriously. And so I just think it was the nature of this film, it was the nature of Bob, of that kind of feeling. But there, you know, of course, you have your moments where you can breathe and feel like that. I knew we had a tremendous actor who had done the work. He spent months transforming into what you see on the screen. Losing weight and so many things that he had to do, learn to dance and sing, and you know, complete transformation. So kudos to him for what he was able to do. And then we tried to support Kingsley with that, with obviously our other cast members who are tremendous, real Jamaicans. And the language is a big part of that. You know, for me, when we set out to make the film, it was like, you know, Snatch was one of my favorite. I loved that. But I was like, but Snatch is like 20 minutes of Brad Pitt where you don't understand him, not 2 hours. You know, so I was like, okay, we can't quite go that far, but, you know, how far can we push it, you know? And, you know, if you watch Bob Marley on, you know, YouTube, you understand him, even if you drop some words. You totally understand what the guy's saying, and you understand the lyrics. And so, you know, when he's singing. So I said, okay, you don't need to understand every word. You know, if you understand every third word, I think you get this movie. 100%. If you understand every fourth, you're confused. And I think we towed that line for a long time, even in the, you know, just are we between three or are we between four? And so, yeah, it was just kind of doing a lot of work to get it into that every third word that you understand, and so that you understand the movie. Can you do it visually? Can you do it with emotion? That's the thing. If you watch the film, do you feel something? It's not about the words. If you strip all the words out, do you feel when you watch the movie? And so that was the approach, and I think we landed on what we landed on, and I feel pretty good about that. And I think it forces you to lean in, forces you to listen, forces you to watch. A lot of the film is in the silence. It's in those moments of breath where you feel for what Bob is going through, his internal struggle. So yeah,
that really was a thing that made it feel real to me when I was watching it. I think sometimes you watch a film and you can have a character where it doesn't feel real enough because they're not, you know, with that accent, it's like you can really go really pony with it, and it was perfectly done. But you know, the cast as well, Ashana Lynch obviously is fantastic in it as well. And what was Kingsley cast first, and then you kind of built around him?
Yeah, that was definitely the key. And obviously, there's flashes to young Bob, and so I knew, you know, Kingsley's on the older side of you know, Bob looked weathered in a good way, still a beautiful man, but definitely looked like he had experienced life. And I think
I can't believe he was 36 when he died.
Yeah,
it's and crazy.
So he looked a little older than his age, and so I thought, you know, it was perfect. Kingsley was playing that age, but then to go into a teenager felt too big of a stretch for me. There was an innocence about the young Bob, so I knew I needed to find two other Bobs to play in the film, and so we did. We ended up finding Quan Enriquez. I can't mess up his last name, but Quan is fantastic, and finding him was a big part of it because he had this innocence, like a purity when you're 15, 16 years old, and then obviously the young Bob, the young boy. But yeah, finding the cast, I mean, was everything. I knew I wanted to put Kingsley in a situation where he was surrounded by real musicians. And we ended up finding real offspring to play in the film. So Family Man Barrett's son is playing Family Man in the film, which is incredible. Yeah. It's like because he has all the stories from his father. He himself is a musician. He actually still plays with the Wailers, so he tours. And it was his first time acting, so it was great. Oh, wow. He was really playing his father and bringing his father to life. Junior Marvin, the same thing. Junior Marvin's son, played by David Kerr, is actually in the film. Oh, so amazing. It's incredible that Kingsley was surrounded by real musicians who actually played in the band, or their offspring played in the band. So that was, you know, that was part of the mental math of, okay, how do we make a film that feels pure, feel real? Well, you have real musicians. Hector Roots Lewis is playing, he's a drummer, he's playing drums for us. And so something very organic about the casting process, real Jamaicans playing real Jamaican parts, and you get the family aspect. So it feels very real. There's nothing that's false about that. And then Kingsley, who taught himself essentially how to play guitar and play like Bob, Bob specific, which is very different. The way Bob strung the guitar is very different than the way other people. You know, the way his fingers were very straight. So I know he spent hours trying to make sure that that was correct. So yeah, it was really, really a very organic process in the casting. Lashana Lynch obviously came a bit more traditional, but what an amazing talent she is. She elevated every scene she was in. She really brought a lot of depth to that role. I think the role expanded from the moment she came onto the film, just because it's somebody fighting for fighting for the truth, fighting for what Rita Marley's story represented in our film. She really pushed us as a film to be better. And so, you know, we had such talent in front of and behind the camera to bring this one to life.
Yeah. I was glad watching it, because sometimes when you watch a movie and you're like, that's not on location, that's like a green screen or whatever. It felt very, did you go out and actually film it on location? And how much of it was shot abroad?
Yeah, so we started the filming here in London, actually. And we had to build a lot of the locations because of, you know, it's a period piece, and London's very busy. But we tried as much as possible to shoot in real locations. So I knew when I went to visit Bob's, where he stayed in Chelsea, you know, it's got the blue placard. I was like, man, I really want to shoot on this street. Can we shut this street down? It's a busy road. Go over the bridge. You know, this is where Bob played football. And we did. You know, I just said, okay, well, let's push it to the end of the shoot and see if we can get the clearances. You know, we could have shot on any other road, but I just thought it would give something to the cast and the crew. This is where Bob actually ran. Why not? Let's try. So as much as possible, we tried to find those spaces, even here in London. And even if we had to visit, okay, this is where the building was, so we can get a, you know. But look, it was shot by Robert Elswit, who shot King Richard for me, one of the greatest living cinematographers to ever do it. Incredible, incredible DP. Our production design, Chris Lowe, also fantastic, was coming off of the Bond world and all of that. And this was a real opportunity for him, and I think he really delivered. But what was great about Chris is that he came from the art director world, and so we knew we had a lot of builds, and he was fantastic with being able to do that on our budget, you know, which was not that high for a movie of our scale. And those two guys working in tandem with each other really were able to deliver and make it feel like we were never on a stage, even when we had to build. And then, of course, going to Jamaica was everybody's favorite part of making this film, because that's the heart. That's the heart of this film. I think we spent 25 days in Jamaica filming. We shot in the streets of Trenchtown. We shot exactly where Bob was, whether it was in the Cane River or, you know, Second Street, Collie Smith Drive, soccer pitches where he was, Strawberry Hill. So we went to all the locations that Bob was, and you felt that. You felt you were on, like, sacred ground in some way that, you know, Bob Marley stood here, and it's pretty special. Hope Road, actually, because it's a museum now. And it's that whole street has changed in 30 years. We actually had to rebuild our Hope Road set, so that was the biggest one. But it was actually, our build was probably more accurate to the real house than what the museum is right now, because of how much that time has changed. And so, yeah, we felt like we really had captured something that was pure and real. And what was great about working with Jamaican crews is that they're not shy to tell you when you're not doing something wrong. So, you know, whether that was an accent or, no, you say it like this. And, you know, they're very protective of Bob, very protective of Bob's legacy. He's a hero. And so whether it was someone on the grip truck or, a driver, you know, they felt very compelled to tell you when we were not doing something right or to help us, because they wanted to support the film. They wanted us to get it right, and that was beautiful. And I'll take a note from anywhere, just to make it real, to make it authentic. That was yeah, that's what we were trying to go for.
It's kind of crazy that this is the first. Well, I think it's the first. I've done my homework, but I'm pretty sure it's the first Bob Marley movie, which is kind of crazy. You know, when you've got Kingsley dressed up as Bob Marley on location, did that draw a crowd? Were there people watching on the streets? Kind of, it must have been a bit mad.
For sure. Well, we were so big, you know, we had a big crew. And so I think we felt very protected. And there were moments here in London, for sure, where I think there was some paparazzi that got in and took some pictures and stuff. But no, we were very protected in the process of making it. And we really wanted to, you know, not let anything leak as much as possible, because, you know, it's important to try to protect the film as much as possible. So we're pretty good about that. But yeah, Bob Marley on the street, people are looking. He looks just like him, you know. And Kingsley did such an amazing job, man. And we, you know, there were a couple moments where we got caught out there, but for the most part, we were pretty protected.
Well, all right, we're jamming.
My life is for people. That I can be beneficial to a people.
And I hope you like jamming too.
In Jamaica, with the support of the Jamaican people, we traveled Bob's journey.
Being in the actual places where these things happen is very special.
It would be an injustice to not have Jamaica's energy in this film.
Just seated in Mount Zion.
We shot up and down the streets of Trenchtown to add authenticity.
Bob Marley, let him through.
Going into Hope Road and seeing where he recorded just activates your imagination.
I wanna jump it with you.
We shot at Strawberry Hill, a location that played a huge role in Bob's life.
And that's where Bob went, and we went too, after the shooting.
We shot the big concert scenes here that actually took place here.
We're creating something special. It's a gift to a legend in his own country.
I was there at the One Love concert. My father being my father, I spread a message of love and unity. Yeah! This is all we are, following in his footsteps.
Every day in Jamaica was magic in that way.
Respect, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All the best.
Thank you to Ronaldo, and thank you to Paramount, and thank you to BB at IDPR. As always, thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp.